The first reading is from 1 Kings chapter 19, and we're starting at verse 15, then to 21. That's on page 361 in the church Bibles. The Lord said to Elijah, "Go back the way you came, and go to the desert of Damascus. When you get there, anoint Hazael, king over Aram. Also, anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, king over Israel. And anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Meholah, to succeed you as prophet. Jehu will put to death any who escape the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will put to death any who escape the sword of Jehu. Yet I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal, and all whose mouths have not kissed him." So Elijah went from there and found Elisha, son of Shaphat. He was ploughing with 12 yoke of oxen, and he himself was driving the 12th pair. Elijah went up to him and threw his cloak around him. Elisha then left his oxen and ran after Elijah. "Let me kiss my father and my mother goodbye," he said, "and then I will come with you." "Go back," Elijah replied. "What have I done to you?" So Elisha left him and went back. He took his yoke of oxen and slaughtered them. He burned the ploughing equipment to cook the meat and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he set out to follow Elijah and became his attendant. And then the next reading is on page 369, and that's 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 to 25. It's page 369. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, the Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," Elisha replied, "but do not speak of it." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, Elisha. The Lord has sent me to Jericho." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went to Jericho. The company of the prophets at Jericho went up to Elisha and asked him, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," he replied, "but do not speak of it." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, the Lord has sent me to Jordan." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives, and as you live, I will not leave you." So the two of them walked on. 50 men of the company of prophets went and stood at a distance, facing the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. The water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit," Elisha replied. "You have asked a difficult thing," Elijah said. "Yet if you see me when I am taken from you, it will be yours, otherwise not." As they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw this and cried out, "My father, my father! The chariots and horsemen of Israel." And Elisha saw him no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and tore them apart. He picked up the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the cloak that had fallen from him and struck the water with it. "Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" he asked. When he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over. The company of prophets from Jericho who were watching said, "The spirit of Elijah is resting on Elisha." And they went to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. "Look," they said, "we saw your servants have 50 able men. Let them go and look for your master. Perhaps the spirit of the Lord has picked him up and set him down on some mountain or in some valley." "No," Elisha replied, "do not send them." But they persisted until he was too ashamed to refuse. So he said, "Send them." And they sent 50 men, who searched for 3 days, but did not find him. When they returned to Elisha, who was staying in Jericho, he said to them, "Didn't I tell you not to go?" The men of the city said to Elisha, "Look, our lord, this town is well situated, as you can see, but the water is bad and the land is unproductive." "Bring me a new bowl," he said, "and put salt in it." So they brought it to him. Then he went out to the spring and threw the salt into it, saying, "This is what the Lord says. I have healed this water. Never again will it cause death or make the land unproductive." And the water has remained wholesome to this day, according to the word of Elisha, according to the word Elisha had spoken. From there, Elisha went up to Bethel. And as he was walking along the road, some youths came out of the town and jeered at him. "Go on up, you bald head," they said. "Go on up, you bald head." He turned round, looked at them, and called down a curse on them in the name of the Lord. Then two bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. And he went on to Mount Carmel, and from there returned to Samaria.
I wonder if we've ever felt frustrated by the part we seemed destined to play in life. Have we ever wished we had more influence on others, a more central role in the world? Have we ever wished our lives had more significance? Why was I cast as a walk-on extra and not as the lead actor? I heard of a performance of Macbeth where one young actor was disgruntled with his casting. He was playing Satan, Macbeth's servant, who I think has a total of 5 lines in the play. The best known is at the moment of Lady Macbeth's demise, when he enters and says, "The Queen, my lord, is dead." And Macbeth launches into one of the most brilliant soliloquies in the English language: "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day." This is the only stage I'm going to get to perform that on. Night after night, this actor would get to say, "The Queen, my lord, is dead," and then hear the other chap doing this brilliant soliloquy. And he got so fed up of his lot in life that one night he got his revenge by changing his line to, "The Queen, my lord, is feeling much, much better." Well, if that sense of frustration is one we can relate to, then we have something to learn from today's passage. We're finishing off our series on Elijah by considering the very unusual end of his time on earth. The story, a true story, but the story we have this morning is a brilliant little one-act drama. And, well, perhaps better, it is one brief act in the single epic drama of God's dealings with his people, and it will help us to understand our part in that drama. So let's start by getting clear on the plot. Here's the synopsis, here's your Spark Notes guide to 2 Kings 2. It is a story about Elijah's departure. First of all, it's a story about Elijah's departure. The main event in the drama is Elijah's ascent to heaven. The author clearly isn't into surprises because he tells us that in verse 1. Do look at verse 1 with me. The Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, he says. So the reader knows right from the start that that's what's going to happen. And everyone else in the story seems to know it too. So there are these other prophets who know it. Verse 3, the company of the prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" And verse 5, the company of the prophets at Jericho went up to Elisha and asked him, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" And guess what? Elisha does know it. So verse 3, "Yes, I know," Elisha replied, "but do not speak of it." Verse 5, "Yes, I know," he replied, "but do not speak of it." There's a nervous expectation about this day because everyone knows it is the day of Elijah's departure. Elisha himself clearly knows it. Verse 9, when they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" And then in the very center of the passage, there is the departure itself. Despite what the England fans were slightly half-heartedly singing yesterday, it wasn't the chariot which carried Elijah home, however sweet. It was a whirlwind which carried Elijah home. Presumably that doesn't scan quite so well. The chariots and the horses of fire function to separate Elisha from Elijah at the moment that Elijah is snatched up to heaven, as well as to say something, as we'll see in a minute, about Elijah's identity. So this is a story about Elijah's departure. His departure raises a massive problem. Who is going to continue his job? Elijah is God's covenant enforcer, And who's going to do that job now? See, 600 years previously, Moses was God's main man. It was through Moses that God had given his people the Old Testament law, their covenant obligations. God had made great promises to his people. They were to be a great nation in their own land with God himself to rule over them and bless them. In turn, his people promised to obey the law that he had given them through Moses. This was a covenant that God had made with his people. And in Leviticus 26 and other places, to motivate the people to keep the covenant, God promised great blessing on them if they were obedient, good health and good harvests. And he also promised curses on them if they neglected the law. There would be drought and attack from wild animals. Moses had been God's agent of this covenant, which the people had promised to keep. But by Elijah's day, they'd pretty much given up on it. They started worshipping Baal instead. That's why there was a drought throughout the land, as we saw a few weeks ago. That was God keeping his covenant promises. Elijah's ministry had been as God's covenant enforcer. He was God's prophet to call people back to faithfulness to the law. You remember the very dramatic way he did that on Mount Carmel with that showdown between Yahweh, the true God, and Baal, the false God. And Yahweh proved himself by sending down fire on Mount Carmel. If he'd sent down fire on Mount Carmel, he could have made himself a giant creme brulee. You groan now, but you'll use it. Anyway, in the midst of national apostasy, in the midst of a series of disastrously unfaithful kings, Elijah had often been the lone voice calling people back to covenant faithfulness, to start following the Lord again. When he's snatched up into heaven in verse 12, Elisha calls him, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel. I don't think he's referring to the chariots and horsemen he's just seen. I think he's referring to Elijah himself. Elijah has been the one-man army of God, protecting God's people, not from external enemies, but from their own unfaithfulness. Elijah has been doing a vital job as God's covenant enforcer, but now he's gone. There are particular jobs that God commissioned him to do that he never got around to. Back in 1 Kings 19, we read that God had told Elijah to appoint Hazael king over Aram and Jehu king over Israel, as well as appointing Elisha to succeed him. The only one he'd got around to was Elisha. So who's going to finish Elijah's to-do list? More generally, and more importantly, the nation's fate seems to be poised on a knife edge. Elijah's been calling them back to the covenant, but it's hardly been an overwhelming success. With him gone, are they just going to slide back into Baal worship? Or will someone pick up the baton? It's like when Heath Ledger died during the middle of filming Dr. Parnassus. The key character was gone. And it puts the whole project up in the air. Will it be called off? Will someone else step in? In fact, three people stepped in and they completed the film to mixed reviews. Who can take over from Elijah? Well, just as Moses was succeeded by Joshua, who finished the job of getting the people into the promised land, now Elijah is succeeded by Elisha, who continues the job as God's covenant enforcer. This is a story about Elijah's departure, but it is also a story about Elisha's succession. It's a story about Elisha's succession. Did you notice the geographical clues to that? So Elijah and Elisha start in Gilgal, verse 1, which is in Samaria, and then verse 2, they go to Bethel, and then verse 4, they go to Jericho, and then verses 7 and 8, they cross the Jordan River, and Elijah's taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. And then Elisha comes back exactly the same route. He recrosses the Jordan, verse 14, goes back to Jericho, verse 18, then back to Bethel, verse 23, and then back to Samaria, verse 25, which is where they started out. Elisha is retracing Elijah's journey. The apprentice is almost literally walking in his former master's footsteps. In verse 9, Elijah asks Elisha, "What can I do for you before I am taken from you?" And Elisha replies, "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit." The double portion is the inheritance that the eldest son would get when a father dies. So Elisha is not asking for twice as much of the Spirit as Elijah had. He's asking to be his heir, to be the one who continues the job that Elijah started. And Elijah says that that is what will happen. Subject to this condition, Elisha's going to have to stick with him so that he sees him go. Which turns out to be a very easy condition to meet, because Elijah goes in the very next verse. And it says Elisha saw this. But then we remember that in verses 2 and 4 and 6, Elijah has given Elisha three opportunities to stay behind. And three times Elisha has declined. So he's met the condition already. He will be Elijah's successor, despite what a difficult job that will turn out to be. And the author really rams this succession business home. Elisha has Elijah's cloak, the one that in 1 Kings 19 Elijah had thrown over him as a funny kind of job offer. He's got the prophetic uniform. And just as Elijah in verse 8 had parted the Jordan by striking it with that cloak, the same thing happens in verse 14, so that Elisha can get back again. "Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" he asks. And he strikes the water, and the Jordan rolls back. The God of Elijah is now the God of Elisha. In verse 15, these other prophets recognize that. The spirit of Elijah is resting on Elisha. But just to check that the old boss really has gone, they insist on sending out a search party. I think they've probably seen the clips on YouTube of whirlwinds picking up cows and depositing them in unlikely places. But no, the old boss is nowhere to be found. He really has gone. He's handed over to Elisha. He's the successor. You can see it in these two stories at the end of the chapter. Remember, faithfulness to God's covenant means blessing. Rejection of God's covenant means cursing. And the blessing or the curse come through God's covenant enforcer. So verse 19, the water is bad and the land is unproductive, the covenant curse. But the people trust and obey the covenant enforcer. They come to Elisha with their problem and they do the things he asks them to do. And Elisha speaks the words of God's blessing. Verse 21, he says, "This is what the Lord says, I have healed this water. Never again will it cause death or make the land unproductive. And the water has remained wholesome to this day, according to the word Elisha had spoken." Respond rightly to God's covenant enforcer, and God will speak his word of blessing. But reject him, and you reject God. That's what these youths do. It's not just a general mockery of bald people. Although I've reluctantly decided that I should probably try and cut down on that a bit as well, so I'm not even going to mention Phil Jack. In our story, it's not just general mockery of bald people, it is the particular rejection of God's personal representative. Reject the British ambassador and you've got the Queen to answer to. This gang of hoodies rejects God's covenant enforcer and they bring the covenant curses on themselves. Youths attacked by wild animals, just as God had promised in Leviticus 26. Not for mocking a bald man, but for rejecting God's covenant enforcer. And if that seems harsh, we must understand that it is only a tiny foretaste of the fullness of God's judgment. Elijah has gone, the covenant enforcer, God's one-man army, has gone, but there is a new sheriff in town. Elisha has picked up the baton. When Elisha dies in 2 Kings 13, the king of Israel calls him the chariots and horsemen of Israel. Exactly the same words as Elisha had used about Elijah. Elisha is now God's one-man army to protect his people from their own unfaithfulness by calling them back to the covenant. This is a story about Elijah's departure and a story about Elisha's succession. But more importantly, it is a story about God's plan. It's a story about God's plan. God gives his people a covenant through Moses, but Joshua has to finish the job of getting the people into the promised land. God calls his people back to the covenant through Elijah. And when it is time for Elijah to go, Elisha seamlessly takes over. In 2 Kings 2, we see that Elijah, apparently the star of the show, isn't really required for God to carry out his plans. The understudy, Elisha, can take over the role of covenant enforcer. The one who really matters is God. What mattered was not what Elijah and Elisha achieved in their lives. What mattered was what God achieved through them. And God used each of them in turn to protect his people from their own unfaithfulness. We need to see our lives from this perspective. When we're frustrated by the smallness of the role we have landed, we need to recognise that what counts is not what I can do with my life, whether that's for my own benefit or for other people's benefit or even for God's. What counts is what God can do in and through my life. I may be cast as Seton, but if my main concern is what people think of Shakespeare and not what people think of me, then I'll forget the frustrations and read my five lines to the very best of my ability. My life has meaning by virtue of the part it plays in God's big plan for the world. Outside of that plan, my life ultimately has no meaning at all. If I actually am the centre of everything, the prospect is grim. The non-Christian position is that each of us is the author of our own drama. But if I'm not only the lead actor, but also the playwright and the director and the producer, when the curtain falls, when I take the final bow, I will find I have been playing to an audience of one, myself. And Macbeth's verdict will be correct. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And so the Christian asks not how important am I, but with Elisha, where is the Lord? Not how can I turn this situation to my advantage, but what is God's will in it? The good news is that we are not the playwright. God is, and he's written a brilliant script. And each of us can have a pivotal role, though it may feel very small. In fact, the author has written himself into the plot. There is a main part, and it's not mine or yours or Elijah's or Elisha's. The part belongs to the one to whom they were pointing, Jesus. This is a story about Elijah's departure, a story about Elisha's succession, a story about God's plan, and lastly, this is a story about Jesus. You see, Elijah disappears off to heaven, and we've asked the question, who will finish the job? Elisha is certainly the successor, and in chapters 8 and 9, he more or less completes Elijah's to-do list of anointing Hazael and Jehu. Although even then, one isn't exactly anointed, and the other gets anointed by proxy, so he doesn't even precisely finish that very small job. And on the more general job of calling people back to covenant to faithful observance of the covenant, well, Elisha does what he can, but the history of the Israelite nation will not allow us to say that he completed the job. The book of 2 Kings is a pretty depressing catalogue of bad kings and unfaithful people and God's judgment. The book ends with Jerusalem being captured by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and the Israelites being shipped off into exile. God's people reject God's law, and they experience God's promised curses. 2 Kings leaves us still asking the question, who will finish the job? As it stands, the play is a Shakespearean tragedy. Something drastic needs to happen to bring God's people back into relationship with him. The Elijah-Elisha pairing looks back in salvation history to the Moses-Joshua pairing, and it looks forward in salvation history too. Luke chapter 1 says that John the Baptist came in the spirit and power of Elijah. So John the Baptist is the new Elijah. And as Elisha's ministry is taken over by Elisha at the Jordan River, so John the Baptist hands over his ministry to Jesus, baptizing him in the Jordan River. Jesus is the new Elisha. The Elijah-Elisha pairing points forward to the John-Jesus pairing. Of course, Jesus is not John's assistant, like with Moses, Joshua, and Elijah, Elisha. John says of Jesus, he who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. The whole of history up until Jesus has been pointing forward to his coming. Jesus is the new covenant enforcer, and he will finish the job. Because Jesus comes not just to call people back to the old covenant, which they were manifestly unable to keep. He comes to institute a new covenant. At the Last Supper, he says, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." As he dies on the cross, Jesus took on himself the curse that his people's disobedience had earned. And so he can offer to us unfaithful people the blessings of the new covenant. We can be perfect people in a perfect new creation under God's perfect rule and blessing. Just as people's response to Elisha brought a word of blessing or a word of curse, our response to Jesus will bring a word of blessing or a word of curse. In Matthew 25, Jesus says there are only two possible endings for each of our stories. When we meet Jesus, he will say one of two things to us. To those who trust and obey him, he'll say, verse 34, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world." What a wonderful ending. Although, of course, it isn't an ending at all, as C.S. Lewis puts it at the end of his Narnia Chronicles. For them, it was only the beginning of the true story, which goes on forever, and in which every chapter is better than the last. But in Matthew 25, verse 41, Jesus, the most loving man who ever lived, said that those who reject him will hear him say these words, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels." Jesus does not say those words lightly or still worse with some malevolent pleasure. Remember that he took that curse as he died on the cross so that we don't need to. But he will not ultimately bless us against our will. There is a main character in this play. The whole of history has been pointing to him. It is Jesus. He offers us blessing or curse. How will we respond to God's covenant enforcer?